That's not my new car, unfortunately. But there is something special, isn't there, about Italian design? The Italians seem to have a special talent for designing things that look attractive, whether it's cars or furniture or buildings or statues. How many people have been to Florence? In Florence, you can't move anywhere without seeing little imitations of the Statue of David. Every shop and every street stall is trying to sell miniature versions, Statue of David. But none of these really prepare you for the real thing in the Academia Museum. It's stunning, absolutely stunning. The building seems to be fitted around the statue, and indeed it was. The building was built specially to house the statue, to accommodate that particular statue. I thought, not only is it beautiful, it's huge. It's not just life-size. It's about three times life size. And that, I think, makes a statement about King David. Apart from Jesus, no one else occupies as many pages in the Bible as King David. His story is told over three books, 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 Chronicles. But apart from the account of his life, we get special insight into his emotions and his feelings. About 50% of the Psalms are ascribed to David. So his part in the story of God's salvation that runs through the Bible is enormous. And what are the opening words of the New Testament? Everybody tell me? The first words of the New Testament, Matthew chapter 1, verse 1. This is the genealogy, family history, if you like, of Jesus the Messiah, the son of David. And when Jesus enters Jerusalem on Palm Sunday, how did the crowd greet him? Hosanna to the son of David. David is larger than life in the Bible. But as well as presenting David as larger than life, Michelangelo has skillfully captured another aspect of King David. Now, if you put one arm down by your side and you're reasonably fit, you'll find that you can see that the veins as the blood, as the heart struggles to pump the blood up. But if you put an arm up at sort of heart level, your arm appears smooth. And Michelangelo has captured that in his statue. In fact, he's exaggerated it. And some art critics believe that in his statue, Michelangelo has observed this, exaggerated it, to emphasize that with David, we get the rough and the smooth. If we study the account of his life, we see the rough side, don't we? A character who is deeply flawed. We see violence. We see a severely dysfunctional family life. We see adultery. We see murder as he seeks to cover up his sin. But we also see the smooth side. We see the wise leader, the skillful musician, the poet. And above all, we see someone who put his trust in God. So the Bible presents us with an honest account of David's life. We get the rough and the smooth, the bad and the good. We see the mistakes and the flaws, as well as the success. But the overall verdict on David is that he was a man after God's own heart. We read of Samuel's message to King Saul, "But now your kingdom will not endure. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart and appointed him ruler of his people, because you have not kept the Lord's command." And 1,000 years after that, the Apostle Paul picks up that same phrase when addressing the people of Antioch. So we read in Acts chapter 13, "Standing up, Paul motioned with his hands and said, 'Fellow Israelites and you Gentiles who worship God, listen to me. After removing Saul, he made David their king. God testified concerning him, I have found David, son of Jesse, a man after my own heart.'" That's the verdict of the Bible. Despite the rough side, despite his sin, that David was a man after God's own heart. The first time Val and I visited Smyrna Home, I was asked to organise a daily Bible study for the group. And we chose to study the life of David from the angle of what he teaches us about leadership. And we had a great time. We did 16 studies of a fascinating character, probably spending an hour or so on each study. Well, this morning, we don't have 16 hours, so I want to focus just on one event in the life of David. We're concluding this morning, aren't we, our study of the people of faith in the book of Hebrews, and the writer simply says, "I do not have time to tell about Gideon, Barak, Samson, and Jephthah," who Simon spoke about last week, "about David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith conquered kingdoms, ministered justice, and gained what was promised. Only three or four words about David and Samuel. And for some reason, the writer reverses the chronological order when he gets to Samuel and David. I'm not sure why, but I'm going to do the same. We're going to look at one event in the life of David, and then I'm going to briefly mention Samuel. If we'd have been workers in fields of Beth Shemesh over 3,000 years ago, we'd have looked up one day and seen an extraordinary sight. Over the hill trundled a cart pulled by two cows with no one to guide them, and on top of the cart was the most precious possession in Israel's history, the Ark of the Covenant. And the cows pulled the cart straight into the village, all by themselves. The Ark of the Covenant. The ark that Moses was instructed to construct to house the tablets of stone on which the Ten Commandments were recorded. But let's jump back a few months before that event. We read the background in the early chapters of 1 Samuel. The Israelites had engaged in a battle with the enemy of the time, the Philistines, and they'd been defeated. They'd been beaten. So they came up with a plan. Next time, they would take with them the Ark of the Covenant. So they summoned Eli's two sons to bring the Ark, and they went into battle again with the Ark, the symbol of God's presence. And they said to themselves, I think, surely God will give us victory if we take the Ark with us. And they got a terrible shock. Not only were they defeated, and not only were Eli's sons killed in the battle, as God had revealed to Samuel, but the Ark was captured by the Philistines. They'd lost their most precious possession. Well, I think that's a lesson for us, lesson number one. God is not like some good luck charm, not like some genie in Aladdin's lamp to be summoned when we want him. He's God. I love that dialogue in C.S. Lewis's allegory in the Narnia Chronicles. You get that fascinating dialogue where Lucy, I think, asks, is he safe? Safe, said Mr. Beaver. Who said anything about safe? Of course he isn't safe, but he's good. He's the king, I tell you. And then Mr. Tumnus adds, he's wild, you know, not like a tame lion. God is not a tame lion, is he? He's God, to be worshipped and feared and respected and obeyed. But then strange things happen. The Philistines have captured the ark. They placed the ark in their temple, the temple of Dagon in Ashdod, opposite the image of their god Dagon. But when they came back in the morning, Dagon had fallen over. So they propped him up again and came back again. And this time he'd fallen over and the head and hands of the idol had fallen off. What was more, the people of Ashdod started falling ill, started dying with tumors. So their rulers met together and they decided that they'd bitten off more than they could chew. This thing was too powerful for them. And the only sensible thing was to send it back. So they put it on a cart, along with valuable offerings of gold, and sent it back over the borders into Israel. Well, I guess that's another lesson for us. God often chooses, doesn't he, to use flawed human beings to do his work. People like you and me, like David, like all the other people of faith who we've thought about over the last few weeks. But he doesn't need to. He's more than capable of acting on his own. So the work of a church, any church, including this church, it's not our work, which we ask God to help with. It's his work, which he sometimes allows us to share in by his grace and for our blessing. It's his work. But the ark continued to present a problem. We read that the people of Beth Shemesh looked into the ark, which they weren't supposed to do, according to God's instruction that which he gave to Moses, and many of them fell ill and died. So they sent it to a nearby town called Kiriath Jearim, where they treated it properly, and the people were blessed, and it remained there for 20 years. And meanwhile, if you know the story, during those 20 years, the people come to Samuel and ask them to appoint a king like the other nations. And Samuel had chosen Saul to be king. And after a promising start, Saul turned away from God and God rejected him as king. And Samuel went and anointed David in his place. And there was a period of turmoil as Saul clung on to power and tried to eliminate David, his rival. And we then get an example of David's genius as a leader. Eventually, Saul was killed in battle, and David was proclaimed king. And the two most powerful tribes at that time were Judah, from which David came, and Benjamin, from which Saul came. And they shared a border. How was David going to make sure that these two tribes were united together? Well, between them, on the border between them, there was a rocky outcrop, a rocky area, which had never been captured by Joshua when he led the people into the land. It was occupied by the Jebusites. And after David had been king for several years, he led the people and captured this area and established the city of Jerusalem as his city, ensuring that neither the people of Judah nor the people of Benjamin would be offended because he'd set up his capital in one or the other. If you know your history of Australia, you'll remember they did exactly the same thing when they united the country. Both Sydney and Melbourne were vying to be the capital, and they decided to build a new city, Canberra, midway between the two, so that neither was offended, following the wisdom of David 3,000 years earlier. So that's a quick flash through part of Israel's history. And after David had established himself in Jerusalem, he reasoned that it was time to bring the ark, the symbol of God's presence, from this town, Kiriath Jearim, and establish it in Jerusalem. So we read in 2 Samuel chapter 6, David again brought together all the able young men of Israel, 30,000. He and all his men went to Baala, that's another name for Kiriath Jearim, in Judah, to bring up from there the Ark of God, which is called by the name of the Lord Almighty, who is enthroned between the cherubim on the ark. They set the Ark of God on a new cart and brought it from the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill. Uzzah and Ahio, sons of Abinadab, were guiding the new cart with the Ark of God on it. And Ahio was walking in front of it. David and all Israel were celebrating with all their might before the Lord, with castanets, harps, lyres, timbrels, sistrums, and cymbals. It must have been great, must it? Fantastic procession, huge number of people, great band, fantastic celebration. But then, if you know the story, disaster struck. So in the next verse we read, when they came to the threshing floor of Nacon, Uzzah reached out his hand and took hold of the Ark of God because the oxen stumbled. The Lord's anger burned against Uzzah because of his irreverent act. Therefore God struck him down and he died there beside the Ark of God. Surely that's one of the most gobsmacking moments in the whole of the Bible, isn't it? Because God doesn't normally strike people down. He normally allows people to suffer the consequences of their sin rather than stop them in their tracks. And we might say, well, that's not fair. God allows people to get away with all sorts of things. He allows a Hitler or a Pol Pot or a Putin to get away with murder, literally. But poor Uzzah, just trying to be helpful, is struck down. But who are we to judge God? We don't know what was going on in Uzzah's thoughts and feelings. neither do we know what God's final judgment will be on Uzzah. We may well find him in heaven. But it is a reminder to us, I think, that God is God. And the reason that he doesn't strike us down when we're irreverent is not because he can't, but because of his love and his mercy. So it's a chastening reminder on us. And the effect on David was devastating. We read in the next verse that then David was angry because the Lord's wrath had broken out against Uzzah. To this day, that place is called Perez Uzzah. David was angry. It's okay to be angry with God. David was angry. In fact, I believe that God will prefer us to be angry than to be apathetic. When we were looking at the life of Jonah a few weeks ago, we read that he became angry with God. And there's a nice poem in the book of Jonah poems that we didn't read at the time. But it's this. At least Jonah talked back to God. Often I do not even do that. That's challenging, isn't it? It's okay to be angry with God, provided that we don't just bottle up that anger, keep it to ourselves. We don't just remain angry, provided that we try and sort it out with God. And provided that we remember that God is God and we're not God. His thoughts are higher than ours. His ways are higher than ours. So David was angry, but he wasn't only angry, he was afraid. David was afraid of the Lord that day. David was afraid if God struck down Uzzah, who was just guiding the car, what might he do to David, who was organizing the whole parade? David was afraid of the Lord that day and said, how can the ark of the Lord ever come to me? He was not willing to take the ark of the Lord to be with him in the city of David. So David parked the ark in a nearby house and went back to the drawing board. And we don't know what exactly passed through David's thoughts in the 3 months it was there, but he must have wrestled with his fear of God and considered, was it right, his desire to bring the ark into his capital city, Jerusalem? 3 months he wrestled with that fear, with those feelings. But we do know a couple of things. We do know that when David did bring the ark to Jerusalem 3 months later, he didn't bring it on the same cart or even another new cart, but it was carried by hand by the priestly clan, the Levites, just as God had instructed Moses that it should be transported. And surely that's another lesson for us. When God does something that we don't expect or we don't see God's blessing, there may well be a simple answer. It may well be that we're being disobedient to God. And we're unlikely to see his blessing unless we trust and obey. That's what faith is, to trust and obey. Just as Debbie reminded us in our first sermon in this series of the men of people of faith in Hebrews. Trust and obey. That's faith. So two things. One, he went back to Moses' rules and got the ark carried. But secondly, some commentators believe that David had a change of heart, which he expressed in one of his psalms, which seems to be written for the occasion of bringing in the ark into Jerusalem. That's Psalm 24. And I thought it would be good to read this together before we spend our last few minutes thinking about this psalm. So I wonder, can you see that? Yeah, I think you can see that. Could the ladies in the congregation read the verses in red and the men the verses in blue? And I will finish it off. Yeah. That's a great psalm. First of all, it reminds us who God is, doesn't it? Right at the beginning, the earth is the Lord's. God is the maker and sustainer of everything, even what's beyond our most powerful telescopes or microscopes. It all belongs to God. And it then asks the crucial question, the question that must have been uppermost in David's mind ever since Uzzah had been struck down. Who may ascend the mountain of the Lord? Who may stand in his holy place? And David's answer, I think, is mind-blowing. For one who has clean hands and a pure heart, who does not trust in an idol or swear by a false god, and that could equally be translated, or swear falsely. Was David being a complete hypocrite? Or did he really believe that those four criteria apply to him? He who has clean hands, that doesn't mean those who wash their hands for a full 20 seconds every time they touch a foreign object. It's a metaphor for those who do what is right, whose actions are right. Would David qualify? You know the story of David. David, who when Saul asked him to slaughter 100 Philistines so that he could take the hand of his daughter in marriage, killed 200 of them and brought parts of their bodies to Saul. David, who would later cause the murder of Bathsheba's husband. Could David really say he's got clean hands? Surely not. And those who have a pure heart, David, who you remember was so angry with Nabal, when Nabal refused to give some food to his men, that he set out to slaughter Nabal and his family. And he was only thwarted by some quick thinking by Abigail, Nabal's wife. Could David really say that he had a pure heart? Or swear falsely? Did David really think he qualified for that? David, who lied to the priest Ahimelech in return for some loaves of bread. That lie resulted in the death of Ahimelech and 85 of his companions. David, who lived at Ziklag amongst the Philistines, if you know the story, for over a year and lived by endless lies and deception. Could David really say that he didn't swear falsely? Had David forgotten all his sins? Or was David being a complete hypocrite? And I don't think either of those are the answer. My understanding is that David had an insight into the gospel that would eventually be proclaimed by his ancestor, the son of David, 1,000 years later. The gospel that we can't and don't deserve to stand before God, but God has made it possible by his death for our sin on the cross of Calvary. Who may ascend the mountain of the Lord? Who may stand in his holy place? Not David. But it's not me, and I don't think it's you as well, probably. The only one who qualifies is Jesus. And the good news of the gospel is that his righteousness is somehow credited to us. He's died in our place for our sin so that we may stand before God. Not because of what we've done, but because of what he has done in it as our representative and our substitute. And I believe that David had an insight into this good news that's proclaimed in our New Testament. But I think there's a hint in the following verse of this psalm. Such is the generation of those who seek him, who seek your face, God of Jacob. Our part is to seek him and to put our trust in him and to follow his way in our lives, to obey him. Yes, of course we should aim for perfection. And of course, by his spirit in our lives, he does transform us slowly. But the good news is that we don't have to achieve perfection, perfection in our deeds or words or thoughts, in order to stand in God's holy place. That's great news, isn't it? Because none of us would qualify, not even King David. So as we close, let's jump quickly back to Samuel, because the story of David, the story of the great king of Israel, starts with the story of Samuel, doesn't it? Samuel, who had the faith and the courage to anoint David as king, in the sure knowledge that if Saul found out, then it would have been the end of Samuel. He'd have killed him. And the story of Samuel starts with that simple response of faith to God's calling that we read earlier, that Sheila read to us, of the small boy responding to God's call and simply saying, "Speak, for your servant is listening." And I think that's the same with all these great people of faith that we've been thinking about over the last few weeks. They listened to God's voice and they trusted and obeyed. And it's the same with us today, isn't it? The start of our journey with faith is listening to God's voice and trusting and obeying. And it's more likely that instead of a voice calling in the night that we can hear, God's word will come to us through the words of his appointed prophets and apostles, which he has provided for us through his scripture. And we need to read it and listen to it and try and understand it and to stand under it to hear God's voice speaking to us. But faith doesn't happen just once at the beginning of our walk with him, does it? Faith is a journey of trusting and obeying God along the way. We've noticed, haven't we, we've looked at the comments on the lives of Abraham and Moses in Hebrews chapter 11, that this little phrase, by faith, occurs not just once, but at intervals through their lives. And I believe that's the same, that the same applies to us. God wants us to trust him every day as we make choices and decisions, the big ones and the small ones, to trust him and obey him, to say to him, "Here I am, what is your way in this situation or in this relationship?" And then to follow God's way, rather than our own way.